Welcome to Federal Insights for May, Business Continuity Month, sponsored by Akamai.
Its people might be working from home, but NASA's work, like that of all agencies, continues. For a review of NASA's top technology priorities and how it's getting them done through the pandemic, we turn to its chief technologist, Douglas Terrier. Mr. Terrier, good to have you on.
Hey, good morning, Tom. It's a pleasure to be with you this morning.
So is it safe to say that those that can are teleworking at NASA?
Well, at NASA, of course, our number one priority is the safety of all of our teammates and employees across the nation. We are very fortunate in the fact that we're probably ahead of the curve on the use of a lot of telework technologies. And so we have pretty much our entire staff is up and working and productive. There are a few people who need to be in the office who are, you know, working on some of the spacecraft, like the Perseverance rover that's about to launch, some of our spaceflight missions that are ready to go that have to be hands-on. They're taking extra precautions and safely working. But the vast majority of our teams are able to continue their work very effectively by telework and telepresence and all the technologies that we've come to know and love.
And one of the questions I've been curious about, and it seems obvious, but when you think about it, it's not. And that is, where does NASA science leave off and technology begin? What kind of an interface is there?
Yeah, that's a really great question. And we tend to make a distinction between those two things, but in fact, there's a lot more overlap than there is a hard line between them. But generally, we can think of science as the concern of asking the big questions of how things work in the universe and what's out there and how we're going to go investigate a planetary surface or investigate a situation on Earth and its climate. And the technology side of the house is really responsible for enabling the engineering solutions that allow us to answer those questions, developing the spacecraft, the sensors, the technologies that enable us to conduct those missions and answer those very hard questions.
Because the chief technologists at regular agencies are concerned with the technology needed to keep the agency going, which usually means information technology. They don't really have any other technology. NASA is all about technology, you know, applied science. And so do you have both the interior and the exterior view in that sense?
That's a great question. And you're absolutely right. Many agencies, many companies use that term chief technologist to refer to IT, information technology. But my role is really to help the leadership team in pursuing and developing all the advanced technologies across a broad range from, as I said, scientific sensors, imaging, to propulsion technology for our rockets, to new materials that we may need to operate in certain environments, new power systems, solar power, clean energy, those across the entire range that we're needed to execute our mission successfully. And I might say one of the cool things about the job, which I happen to think I have the best job in the world, but one of the coolest parts of it is we at NASA are keen to look not just internally for those solutions, but to look externally across crowdsourcing, across citizen scientists, across the world in academia, with other federal agencies and private sector companies. So I really tried to be in contact with and in collaboration with scientists all around the world in all fields to both keep up with technologies that we need inside NASA and fund and promote technologies and innovation within NASA, but also to keep touch with, collaborate with, and really foster technology and innovation outside NASA and the broader community as well.
And how does this all work functionally? Because you've got the launch centers and you've got the different mission directorates. I mean, it's a complicated piece of apparatus bureaucratically, NASA, and each one of them has the technologies endemic to what it's trying to do. So how do you arrange all this programmatically?
That's exactly right. And it is, in fact, very complicated, a rather distributed system of independent and brilliant scientists across 10 field centers around the country. Some of them concerned with human space flights at the flight centers in Houston and Kennedy and Marshall, for example. Some concerned with primarily with Earth science, such as our scientists at Goddard Space Flight Center, for an example, in Maryland. Some concerned with planetary and looking at rovers on Mars, as we're familiar with the JPL, Jet Propulsion Laboratory in California. And really, my goal is to ensure that we have both the specific expertise needed at each of those centers that is really aligned with the missions that they're primarily concerned with, but more importantly, to look for those cross-cutting technologies and investments that we can make that really cover the entire suite of capabilities that we operate. And as I said, again, in cooperation with academia, other government agencies, and the private sector, to both promote and fund where we see advanced technologies that could have use for NASA to bring into our ecosystem of innovation, but also really to help promote innovation broadly across other sectors that can be useful in other sectors of the economy, and generally promote better quality of living across our lives here on Earth.
Douglas Terrier is Chief Technologist at NASA. I'm Tom Temin.
Today, more than ever, upholding the mission of your agency is paramount. Whether that means ensuring the efficiency of remote workforce performance or scaling application availability and reliability, Akamai is here to meet you where you are and get it done securely and seamlessly. Having supported the public sector for more than 20 years, Akamai is a trusted provider to each of the nation's cabinet-level agencies. To learn more about how Akamai can support your agency's remote workforce and business continuity, visit us at akamai.com.
We're speaking with Douglas Terrier. He is the chief technologist at NASA. And how do you know when some sort of disruptive technology might come along that could change something that was a given? I'll just make up one. You think of spacecraft as made of metal, and they have to go very far, and there's talk about going to Mars for a couple of years, back and forth each way. In the aircraft industry, everything's moving to composites. So how do you know, what's the mechanism by which NASA may discover, hey, this is a disruptive technology for us, but one that could really help the mission?
So we actually have our technology portfolio, which I helped to administer. We have it divided into, you know, several kind of stages, if you will, looking from very early stage advanced research onto the development activities. And then, of course, the infusion and actual building of spacecraft, where we're actually taking technology and infusing it into hardware. And our investments and grants that we provide are distributed kind of into those three buckets, with a lot of the, as you might imagine, a lot of the third stage, the advanced stage technology work being done in our aerospace company partners and at NASA itself, building spacecraft, building new sensors and so on. But we have a significant amount of investment that's done in what we call early stage innovation, where we look for, actively seek out and have mechanisms for academia. A lot of graduate students are supported through that, a lot of graduate studies throughout the nation and internationally, where we look for those nuggets of technology where we see, like as you said, for example, advanced materials, advanced propulsion systems, quantum computing, for example, would be another example, artificial intelligence, where we look for those emerging technologies, both within the NASA community and throughout the technology sector and other industries as well. And we actively seed and foster, cultivate those efforts to try to bring them along in maturity where they're ready to then move on to the next stage for application. And that's done through a very rigorous process where we partner with the National Academy of Sciences, among other bodies, to help to comb through that broad network of innovators around the world. And we increasingly are using, in addition to, you know, the typical grant announcements that we may do with universities, for example, and data calls through various science proposal calls, we increasingly are using tools like crowdsourcing, where we reach out to citizen scientists and the public in general, often from other fields, where we find solutions coming into our world from outside of, even outside of aerospace.
Sure. And I guess you and NASA as an organization has to have a mechanism for knowing when something is moving beyond that stage of grant exploration, other transaction authority for prototyping or crowdsourcing, to when it is commercialized and you can get it through a contract.
That's right. You know, that actually can take two forms. One of them is we have among our many mission directorates, so we have four basic mission directorates. Think of those as operating companies, one being the human spaceflight, which is concerned with building, of course, the human exploration systems, one being our science mission directorate concerned with a lot of our robotic exploration of both the universe around us as well as earth science. The third being aeronautics with aircraft and flight within atmosphere. But we have a fourth called a space technology mission director that's primarily concerned with funding those generalized technology evaluations that then feed those three other missions that I just mentioned. And we have a pretty rigorous system of determining what we call TRL, technology readiness level, determining when you move from that early stage, 1, 2, 3, to early technology development into the mid levels and the, 4, 5, and then on to when we move all the way up the ladder to those things that are ready for application. And generally, they move into different funding mechanisms as you kind of graduate up that scale of technology readiness.
And do you have a certain number that just never pan out? Maybe someone came with a promising phosgene-powered jet engine, but it just never worked out.
Yeah, so as you can imagine, that's one of the most, one of the most difficult balances to strike in a lot of my job. And I might add, I have at each of the field centers, the 10 field centers I mentioned around the country, we have a local chief technologist that supports my office working with the scientists and engineers in that, not just at those centers, but in that region, including the universities and companies in that region. And what we tend to do, as you might imagine, is try to look for those diamonds in the rough. One of the features of that kind of investigation is that you would expect in the early stage that you might invest in things that look promising, and a substantial numbers of those don't turn out to be successful, which is just part of the process where if you were to always be 100% sure that you had a winner, you might miss some really neat gems that you just didn't expect. So we do see and do tolerate and do expect and encourage a bit of trial and error early where it's safe. We're talking about laboratory experiments, research experiments. And as you move up that ladder, we then tend to narrow that down to more and more proven solutions by the time you get to applications, certainly to large missions or human spaceflight, for example. You've got a technology that's very well understood, very safe, and very proven.
Douglas Terrier is chief technologist at NASA. Thanks so much for joining me.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you so much, Tom.
To share this interview or hear it again, go to federalnewsnetwork.com and search Federal Insights. I'm Tom Tamman.
Today, more than ever, upholding the mission of your agency is paramount. Whether that means ensuring the efficiency of remote workforce performance or scaling application availability and reliability, Akamai is here to meet you where you are and get it done, securely and seamlessly. Having supported the public sector for more than 20 years, Akamai is a trusted provider to each of the nation's cabinet-level agencies. To learn more about how Akamai can support your agency's remote workforce and business continuity, visit us at akamai.com.
Members of Congress, wherever they might be, have not missed receiving a congressional record, nor have executive branch agencies failed to receive the Federal Register. That's all thanks to measures taken by the Government Publishing Office, which also has most of its people teleworking. For an update, we turn to the GPO's director, Hugh Halpern. Mr. Halpern, good to have you back.
Good to talk to you, Tom.
So give us the general state. You have most people teleworking, but not everybody, and you yourself have a pretty heavy telework schedule.
It's kind of interesting, Tom. Unlike most federal agencies, GPO is actually a manufacturing operation. So we run a printing plant that produces the congressional record, the Federal Register, bills, hearings, reports for Congress. But we also run a line which produces passports and secure identification items and all sorts of things like that. So going into the situation, we've had to adjust a little bit differently than some of the other federal agencies. We have a significant number of our folks teleworking. I'm teleworking. I'm talking to you from my basement. That's where I meet with our executive team daily, and we've got all sorts of our GPO teammates, whether they're in IT or human capital or our design team, all of those folks are working from home. The folks who work on our passport line, unfortunately, aren't working right at the moment. We're lucky that we've got a big backlog or a big backstock of passports so we can continue to supply those to the State Department. And then we have another set of folks who are supporting the work of Congress, the work of the agencies through printing the congressional record and the Federal Register in plant. Now, they're much smaller teams than what we normally use, but we're still getting that work done. And I also don't want to leave out our good customer service folks who are working from home too, supporting the federal agencies who are procuring printing and other items through the numerous contract printing firms we use all across the country.
And I guess it's worth pointing out, just to tell people that this is not a academic situation that's causing this, is that you did lose a contract guard at the GPO main headquarters?
We did. This was actually a really tough weekend for the GPO family. We've got a mix of employees and contract employees, but we're really kind of one big family. And unfortunately, over the weekend, we learned that one of our contract special police officers contracted coronavirus and COVID-19 and unfortunately passed away as a result of the disease over the weekend. This was our first known infection among our folks since we've learned of one other, but we're taking measures in terms of social distancing and those kinds of things to try and really minimize the degree to which we've got further infections.
And did you take any special measures in terms of cleaning out the entryways and so on? Because I think everyone passes through that little area where the guards are.
Yeah, no, that's true. This particular guard was at one of our other entrances that's not trafficked quite as heavily. But that said, one of the benefits of being a manufacturing operation is that we have really good industrial cleaning crews. And they were able to come in and clean all of the areas where this particular person was to the CDC standards using material recommended by them.
We're speaking with Government Publishing Office Director Hugh Halpern. With respect to the people that do need to be in there to operate the presses and the inkjet printers, I guess it takes fewer people than it used to operate the regular old-fashioned presses. And you also have rearranged the schedule so that there's lower person density in the buildings?
Absolutely, Tom. We're trying to do as many innovative things as we possibly can to minimize exposure and to really put safety first for everyone who's working at GPO. So for those folks who do have to come into the plant, what we've done is we've split folks into two teams. And so we will work 1 week with one team and the next week with another team. And that enables us to do two things. One is maintain some social distancing. And two, in the unfortunate circumstance that somebody does become infected, it doesn't knock out the entire workforce. Second, we've got groups that are teleworking that have never teleworked before. Some of our congressional folks are working on that as well. And we're really benefiting from some of the investments we've made in technology. When you came to visit us, we showed you our new inkjet presses, our digital inkjet presses. And one of the benefits from those is it requires a lot fewer folks to manufacture the congressional record or the Federal Register. If we were doing this in an offset environment, it could be 25, 30 people required to produce that document start to finish. With inkjet technology, we can do that with far fewer people, even as few as half a dozen.
And you're also finding ways to reach out with local school districts and printing materials for them. Tell us about that.
As I mentioned earlier, we've got a very robust program where we procure printing for most of the federal government. And one of those programs is our GPO Express program. one of the things that we were able to do was make that program available to the District of Columbia. And through that, they were able to procure printing and get a lot of educational packets printed for the DC school system. So it's easier for them to educate their kids during this period where everybody is at home learning.
You mean an arm of Congress caused homework for all the kids in the district?
I wouldn't go that far. We didn't assign the homework. We're just making it easier for them to get their assignments done.
I guess it is easier for the teleworking and tele-teaching teachers if there are materials in the hands of the people at home trying to log on.
Absolutely. You know, everybody's working through this now. It's a different environment. My son's 17. He's a junior in Alexandria, T.C. Williams High School in Alexandria. And, you know, he's working online mostly, but not everybody in the district can do that. And, you know, I think the district was looking for something that could supplement their online offerings. And luckily, GPO was in a position to be able to help them with that.
And the last question, last I heard, it was National Library Week. And GPO is always heavily involved in that because of the depository activity that I guess still happens even in the digital age. How are you handling that?
Absolutely. It is National Library Week. I'll be talking to our Federal Depository Library Council. And our Federal Depository Libraries are about 1,100 libraries across the country, where we make sure that they've got the materials that the federal government produces so that they're easy for folks to access, whether it's physical volumes in a library or it's through our govinfo.gov online repository. And, you know, our FDLP partners are really key to making sure that folks can access the information that GPO produces on behalf of all of our federal customers. We'll be talking about how we can be servicing those libraries a little bit better and how we can help them service the library patrons who are ultimately the customers for the federal government, for federal government information.
And I guess this is really off the wall, but it must be a question that comes up. Probably it does in every office and everyone who goes to the mailbox. But do we know whether coronavirus can live very long on paper?
You know, I'm going to leave that to to the scientists and the experts at the CDC. That said, my understanding is that by the time you get a congressional record or a federal register, it's probably gone through so many processes that it's pretty safe. So
go ahead and open it and read away.
There you go.
Hugh Halpern is director of the Government Publishing Office. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Tom. Really appreciate it.
To share this interview or hear it again, go to federalnewsnetwork.com and search Federal Insights. I'm Tom Temin.
Thank you for listening to Federal Insights for May, sponsored by Akamai on Federal News Network.
Today, more than ever, upholding the mission of your agency is paramount. Whether that means ensuring the efficiency of remote workforce performance or scaling application availability and reliability, Akamai is here to meet you where you are and get it done securely and seamlessly. Having supported the public sector for more than 20 years, Akamai is a trusted provider to each of the nation's cabinet-level agencies. To learn more about how Akamai can support your agency's remote workforce and business continuity, visit us at akamai.com.